Hey, drama listeners, it is Dylan. I know you're absolutely gagged just reading that Jason Robert Brown sat down with Connor and I for a chat. We are so excited to share it with you, and he tells absolutely amazing stories, indulges us as we praise him a little bit and ask questions about some of our favorite songs and shows. Obviously, he has so much going on, and it meant a lot to us that he took the time in the middle of his busy season, which honestly, I feel like JRB is always in a busy season. So, if you love this episode and then you're enjoying drama, newly partnered with iHeartRadio Broadway, it would mean the world to us if you would support us on our Patreon, patreon.com/thedramapodcast. We have Drama Plus, which is monthly bonus episodes from Connor and I, as well as being part of our Instagram close friends. It really means the world to us. It helps us keep churning out content. All right, I'm not going to let a single second go by. It's time. Jason Robert Brown on drama. Let's get on with the show.
Press play.
Curtain up and now we're in.
It's time to take spin.
The shade and tea to spill.
Ooh, drama.
Oh, that's a tweet. Did they book?
Who got nom?
They option no.
Oh, I'm not well.
What star will we talk to today?
Oh, that's a gag, honey.
Say no more.
Drama.
Drama. Welcome to Drama, a podcast that covers theater,
pop culture,
love
and life.
I am Connor McDowell.
And I am Dylan McDowell. Connor, we got a big one today.
I'm so excited.
I know. I want to jump into a quick story about the first time we ever saw our guest live. And it was a dark day in our nation's history.
One of the darkest that comes to mind, you know.
It was the first year we lived in New York. And we bought tickets to see Kristen Chenoweth's I think it was called A Love Letter to Broadway.
Okay.
And
I wanted to say For the Girls, but that was her one after that.
That was her next one.
Okay.
And we said, you know what? It was on election day. And we said, day after.
Yeah,
and we
yeah.
said, whatever happens, we want to be in a Broadway theater and have a fun night. And it just so happened that today's guest was the special guest.
And who would have thought the outcome that day? I mean, to go back 8 years and think, we were like... I was so depressed. I'll never forget walking to work that morning crying. Like everybody in the office was, I've never seen anybody, like it was like a true dark cloud over everybody in the city. And I remember we ordered like all this like greasy bar food for lunch at work. And everybody was just like devastated and trying to
get a little nice treat. But treating ourselves to Broadway was the best thing we could have done. And then our guest today premiered a new song. It was called Hope.
Yeah. I was gagged.
It was a gag of a moment for sure. Our guest today is a Tony Award winning, Grammy nominated composer, lyricist, conductor, arranger, orchestrator, director, and performer. His musicals have defined generations, including The Last 5 Years, Songs for a New World, Parade, 13, and more. His musical repertoire includes Mr. Saturday Night, The Connector, Honeymoon in Vegas, Urban Cowboy, Prince of Broadway, the recent Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, and our favorite, The Bridges of Madison County. His distinctive style has solidified him as one of the most prolific writers of our time, having also released albums Coming From Inside the House, How We React and How We Recover, and Wearing Someone Else's Clothes. His songs have become concert and cabaret standards, having been recorded by artists such as the aforementioned Kristen Chenoweth, Billy Porter, Ariana Grande, Audra McDonald, Jennifer Nettles, and beyond. This living legend has received countless awards and accolades, sold out concerts around the world, and is a household name beyond theater fanatics. You can witness his greatness live at Carnegie Hall on October 25th, alongside Heather Headley and Ben Platt. Please welcome to Drama, Jason Robert Brown.
Hi. I feel like I'm supposed to sing it back. Hi. I'm all right. You know, I'm a middle-aged Jewish guy in the middle of election season. So, you know, I'm okay. I'll be better eventually.
Yes. Yes,
I know.
Will.
It's so ironic you mentioned election season, just with that whole little story we mentioned up at the top. Do you remember that day? I mean,
Yes. You know. I mean, it was that is Kristen had invited me to be part of that concert a couple of months before. And I don't remember even thinking that it was going to be on election day. I just sort of wrote it in my calendar. I was like, okay, there's a Wednesday night, I guess I'll come and sing with Kristen. That sounds like fun. And then I woke up that morning and I hadn't slept the night before. You know, I had two girls who were in middle school and they were both in girls' schools. And it was like walking into a tomb. It was unbelievable how horrible that morning was. And I just thought, well, what am I supposed to sing? You know, what on earth could I possibly sing in front of this whole crowd of people at the L'Enfantin Theater? You know, I'm not going to sing When You Say Vegas. It's like Moving Too Fast does not seem like the thing that I should do at the moment. And I'm not a fast writer. I haven't been for a long time. But while I was in the cab taking my daughter to school, I started writing some lyrics on a notepad. And by the time I got home, I had the whole shape of the song was all there. And I sat down at the piano and I pressed record and I just did it. And that's the song. That's the way it's always been. I haven't changed it since then. Then I premiered it that night and I was terrified because, you know, there's no way to know what the politics of anyone's audience is going to be, especially Kristen's audience, which is very broad. And I thought, well, I mean, you know, you ask me to do something, you're going to get what you get, which you two are finding out right now, you know, but, you know, I can only be sort of the best version of me that I am.
Absolutely. Wait, so did you have a plan prior to then what you were going to do?
No, I wasn't worried about it a whole lot. I mean, I have a bunch of, you know, because I play for myself, I never have to worry about like what, I have probably 15 or 20 songs I can pop out at any given time. But it all seemed like a bad idea. I mean, it was amazing to just have an entire repertoire that was totally inappropriate. It was an astonishing moment.
Yeah. I mean, it was a very cathartic moment for us as people sitting in the audience. Actually, I'll never forget, Kristen said something like, if you acknowledged, you know, Hillary Clinton and the election, et cetera, in those moments, and that these two gals next to me had their arms crossed, like they were like teen girls too. Like they were like, ugh, rolling their eyes. And I was like, oh man, this is a broad audience, you know, like Kristen really brings them all in.
Yeah, I was in the audience for the first act and there was a guy across the row from me in a, like in a fucking cowboy hat. I mean, he was full on. He was in like arms folded, like any, like loved Kristen. And incidentally, like, isn't that a giveaway? But loved Kristen, loved the whole thing. But then anytime it got at all like lefty, he just like performatively just folded his arms and scowled. Like, okay.
That broken arrow audience, you never know who Kristen's going to bring around, you know. She does appeal to everyone.
She does.
But anyway, so we ask you how you're doing. We do like to ask all of our guests this question. Are you well? We kind of like to meet you where you're at, kind of just see what's going on in your life right now. Any projects or anything that you have going on?
Well, there's all sorts of things going on. It's a very busy time. The thing that is most on my mind at the moment is that I'm going to be making my solo debut at Carnegie Hall on October 25th. Which is really exciting and a little scary because I've played concerts my whole life and I've played big halls, but Carnegie Hall is a big, it's a significant hall. I don't want to let Carnegie Hall down. I would feel bad if Carnegie Hall got mad at me. So there's a big orchestra and Heather Headley is coming and Ben Platt is coming. And also Shoshana Bean is going to be part of it. And Jay Harrison G is going to be part of it. Georgia, my wife, is conducting. So I have to be on my good behavior. It's a lot of pressure. And I would appreciate it if you guys did not increase the pressure on me right now. Okay. So it's a lot. So I have that. And then obviously we are in pre-production for the revival of the last 5 years with Nick Jonas and Adrian Warren, which is going to, I believe you might say it's going to slay. And
You're correct.
It's really exciting. I have a meeting tomorrow to see the set designs, which I already have a little inkling of what they're supposed to be, but they sound so awesome. So that's going to be very cool. And we also have the tour of Parade going out. And so we've been casting that. I think we may have finished casting that last week, but you're not going to know that for a while. But
can you give us a hint?
Yeah, Liza Minnelli is going to be playing Leo Frank.
Wow.
The gays are going to go crazy.
Finally. So we have the Parade tour, which is the amazing thing is that Parade ever toured in the first place. But the fact that we now have a second tour of Parade going out is not something I expected I would be saying. So that's really very moving to me. I'm thrilled that story is staying out in the world like that. And then, as though that wasn't all enough, but on October 25th, the same night that I'm playing Carnegie Hall, we are releasing an album of the concert I did at Town Hall with Stephen Sondheim. And so that will now go into a wide release on anywhere that you get your music. And we're also doing a vinyl edition, which will come out shortly thereafter. But so that was me and Steve Sondheim and Katrina Lenk and Joshua Henry and Shoshana Bean and Rob McClure and Lin-Manuel Miranda. And it was an amazing night. And we were lucky enough to capture it. And now we've been lucky enough to get it mixed and mastered. And it's coming out on Concord. So I have all of that, not to mention the three shows that I'm writing, you know, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. You know, that seems like plenty. Is that good? That's enough.
Yeah, I mean, the most anyone has ever mentioned. That is incredible, though. You keep us fed. You know, it's remarkable. Sometimes, you know, people have favorite songwriters, composers, musical theater writers, but they deliver maybe one or two great works. But as I even read in the bio, you have had so many defining pieces that have been released, and we're grateful for it. So thank you.
You know, I think what has been important to me all along is that I be proud of each of the pieces, that not think of this one as like, this was the real one and the other ones were like ones that I did, but I wanted to be proud of the body of work. And that phrase, it comes up with for me a lot, just to talk about, I don't write a show, I'm really engaged in a sort of very long-term project. Oh, I hope it's very long-term, you know, to sort of tell my stories the way I want to tell them. And all of those shows have been part of that project. And it's been, you know, a sometimes extremely frustrating process, but it's this beautiful challenge to keep finding voices within myself and telling stories with them. It's the privilege of my life, and it's also an enormous pain in the ass, but I love that I get to do it.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I also want to say congrats on your solo debut at Carnegie Hall coming up. That's absolutely incredible. And it's going to be with the team that you mentioned that's performing with you and around you. There's no way it's going to go badly, I promise you.
Now, can I ask you, when people listen to the podcast, can they tell you two apart? Like, do they know when you're talking who's Connor and who's Dylan?
Sometimes.
I don't think so personally, but, you know, sometimes people will ask, they'll say, oh, one of you said this or one of you asked that.
I'm going to close my eyes for a while and see if I know who's talking.
I think I have a little bit more of a higher pitched voice at times than Connor. I don't know.
I've been told I use more vocal fry.
Uh-huh. All right, good. This is a good guide. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know I do.
Sometimes I'll even address Dylan by name so that the listeners know who is asking the other twin the question. I mean, it was really smart of us as twins, with identical twins, by the way, with basically the same voice, to start an audio only format for people to get to know us. I mean, we were really thinking broadly there.
This Sondheim Town Hall concert that you did, when did that happen?
That was in 2019.
Okay.
For 6 years, I had a residency at a place called Subculture, a wonderful music venue downtown. And what that residency meant is that every month I did a different concert, and there was always someone different who came to sing with me. And sometimes it was, you know, Betty Buckley or Sutton Foster or Raul Esparza. And sometimes it was people who were just coming up. It was, you know, Catherine Gallagher or Todrick Hall, or, you know, there were ultimately 60 some odd concerts that we did. And at one point we wanted to celebrate Cynthia Erivo was coming to the States for the first time. She had only, you know, ever done Color Purple in London, and nobody knew who she was. Her first night in New York City, she actually did a Subculture show with me and with Joshua Henry. And it was this huge thing. And so we all tried to figure out what we could do that would be really fun together thereafter. And I'm a big supporter of the Brady Foundation for gun control. Mm-hmm. And so we decided that we would do a concert of the last 5 years with Joshua and Cynthia at the Town Hall, which was not where we usually did the concerts, but for Brady. And we raised $200,000 for Brady, and we got to do the concert, and that was really great. So then we thought, well, maybe we'll just do these regularly. I mean, the end of that part of the story is that Subculture closed during the pandemic, so that's why I don't do them anymore. But what we were starting was the idea that every year or maybe a couple of years, I would do a concert at Town Hall that was an extension of the residency. So it was coming up on the 50th concert, and we thought, well, we should really do a big blowout for number 50. That's a big deal. So we booked Town Hall, but we didn't have a guest. And I just figured we would just do a thing. The whole thing was going to be a benefit for Brady again. And so I was on a plane. I hadn't thought about it before I got on the plane. But while I was on the plane, I just thought, oh, you know what? It'll be really funny. I'll ask Steve and he'll say no. And that'll be the end of that. So I just typed in this thing about the Brady thing and about how Cynthia and I had done this all those years before. And would he, you know, just come and... I didn't know what he would want to do, but would he come and do it? And I thought he'll write no, and then we can all move on. And by the time the plane landed, he had written back and said, I would be happy to do anything with you. And I thought, you would? Why? What is that? That's a crazy talk. And so he came. It was June 2019. And Katrina was the sort of the headline guest. And so Katrina did Last Midnight, and she did Move On with Joshua Henry. And then she sang Not While I'm Around with me and Steve playing for her. And you can see that there's a video of that on Vimeo or YouTube or whatever the thing is.
Okay.
And then along the way, I just asked anyone, you know, I mean, no one said no. So anyone who I thought would be fun to have come on board, came on board. So Shoshana and I did the next 10 minutes from the last 5 years, and Rob McClure did I Love Betsy, and Lin-Manuel and I did Franklin Shepherd Inc. from Merrily We Roll Along. And it was, you know, it was a 20-piece orchestra, and it was, you know, we raised $300,000 for Brady. And, you know, there's like, there are the things where you're like, oh, that's on my bucket list. But then there's things you're like, well, I'll never get to do that, but wouldn't it have been? I mean, and I actually got to do this thing that I would never, I shared a stage with Steve, and we played pianos together and we sang. And I not only feel great for myself that I got that, because like, how cool does that make me sound now? But I got to give it to Steve. Like, I got to give my hero this thing where he got to make music in public, which is not, you know, Steve was very nervous about being out in public. It wasn't his thing. But whenever he did show up, it was usually he would give a speech, or sometimes he would sort of very nervously like play, you know, he'd do Anyone Can Whistle was always the one thing. But instead, I just said, we've got all the time and you've got a piano and let's just do stuff. And it was a beautiful thing to watch him make music that way. And so I feel like I got to give him a gift, which, you know, I can't think of anyone in my life who I would want more to give a gift to. It was a special night.
Oh my gosh.
That's beautiful.
And now you're giving the gift to all of us by letting us hear it on an album.
Exactly. Well, and I mean, Concord is really giving you the gift. I'm glad they're doing it.
I loved Subculture, by the way. Oh, yeah. That was an amazing place. It was felt fun to go downtown. And Connor, when I went, we saw you do with Jeremy Jordan. My friend Kelly and I saw you with Cynthia Erivo, not the first time when she came back later. And then I got to see you with Stephen Schwartz and Jessica Vosk. That was like an early one as well. That, and again, two pianos on stage, very cool.
Those are probably my favorite concerts of the series, the composer concerts. I did one with Tom Kitt, I did one with Shayna, I did one with Grace McLean, I did one with Duncan Sheik, and then obviously the one with Steve. And those were the ones that felt the most special, like I was making a community that didn't really exist until then. It felt really great to do that. And it forged a relationship with me and Shayna and me and Grace that I feel like I get to say I knew their stuff beforehand, you know, that I was putting them out in the world and saying, listen to what these people can do, these great writers. Mm-hmm. So, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, you've been championing Shayna for a long time. I was in preparing for this. I listened to some old interviews you did, and you were talking about her back in like maybe 2018, 19. And here she is now collecting Tonys.
I like it when people give her awards. It makes me happy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, you know, there's a lot of people who like write musicals, and I don't generally love the music. I mean, if you ask me what I think about sort of the sound of musical theater, it's not a sound I particularly enjoy. Like, I don't listen to musicals as a general rule. And then Shayna writes stuff that I'm like, no, I want to listen to that. She has a sense of groove and an open-heartedness that's not just about sort of like, I think I'm a little bit allergic to unearned emotion. And everything about Shayna's work feels very earned to me. Those the writers that I respond most to, it feels like they really earn it.
Wow. Yeah, that's a really cool way to put it. I've heard you say that in other interviews, that you're not like this musical theater fanatic, which in terms of like listening to the music, which I actually relate to that. I don't listen to a ton of show tunes properly. I do listen to your music a lot, Jason.
Well, thank you.
A lot.
I mean, I happen to love show tunes from the 50s and the 60s. Like I'm an old school show tune guy. And of course I love all of Steve's stuff and Stephen Schwartz's stuff. You know, there are a lot of composers for the musical theater who I really respond to. But for me, it's partly musical. I mean, well, more than probably partly. And so, you know, the music has to have a level of depth and layers to it so that I can really respond to it. And so I think if music is facile, it can still do what it does. It can still get the job done and can be very moving and very beautiful, but it doesn't draw me in as much because I this might just be my ego or whatever. I mean, like I have an ego, but I think because I'm a very well-trained musician, which I spent a long time doing and which, you know, anyone can do if they want to be. So I'm a very well-trained musician and I think I can hear past very simple music. And so if I can hear past it very quickly, there's not a lot for me to do. You know, I just sort of like, all right, I guess we'll just go bumping along with this and that's fine. Whereas people who aren't trained may feel like, you know, the mystery is being revealed to them. I'm ahead of it in the same way that, you know, you always say you don't want to be ahead of the characters in a story. You know, I can get ahead of the music pretty fast. And then for me, I'm just sort of like, all right, well, I guess I'll just wait until it's done. And oh, look, yep, that it did what I thought it was going to do. Okay, great. So you know, I like my music to have... I remember I did a concert a long time ago. Don't ask how this happened, but I ended up on a concert with a bunch of smooth jazz artists. And I was with the singer Tierney Sutton, and Tierney came out and she said, you know, I don't really do smooth jazz. I like my jazz bumpy. And I think that's how I like my music in general. I like it crunchy. I think I leave the smooth to other people, but I prefer the crunchy.
That's totally fair. Okay, so you obviously, you know, you just acknowledged you're a trained musician. You mentioned earlier that Stephen Sondheim was your great hero. We like to kind of revisit those early sort of influences that, you know, solidified you as knowing this was a life that you wanted to pursue, a life in the arts. We call it the Ring of Keys moment, inspired from a moment in Fun Home. Do you feel like you have a Ring of Keys moment?
You know, you prepped me for this, and I've been trying to think about it, but I have to say, I don't know that I can isolate it super easily. I mean, first of all, I'm old, but it's also, I mean, here's the thing that the thing that I kept coming back to, which is not, it's not the answer to the question you're asking me, but when I was in third grade, I was in a production of Macbeth and I played Banquo. And first of all, I was pissed because I should have played Macbeth and Chris Kornatowski did, and because he was blonde, I guess, you know, all right, let the Jewish kid play the ghost. So fine. So I was Banquo. I remember like really feeling much more comfortable on the stage than everybody else felt. Like I was, you could see everybody was like, they didn't know how to talk or, you know, they didn't know where to look. And I was like, no, you just look out, you know, you look to the person you're talking to and all of that. And then I had to do the ghost thing, which is ridiculous. And it was obviously... I have to say, I hope you all figured this out, but it was obviously a sort of a condensed child version of Macbeth that I did. But the only thing that I remember most, like, you want to have learned something every time you perform, and I try to. And the thing I learned is that when you die on stage, make sure that your arm is going to clear the curtain so that when the curtain comes down, your arm is not still sticking out. And you have to then slowly pull it back under the curtain, which will provoke laughter. There is no sure on that. So that's my Ring of Keys moment, is not really that, but I will say I was in Macbeth in third grade, and there it is. That's how I started down the path I'm on now. It's so not true, but it's a good story, and that's what really counts.
I like the story. And I like that you were kind of, you know, you could always say Banquo's ghost was already taking the body away, you know?
Yeah, sure. Something like that.
You mentioned that you're working on this revival of the last 5 years, which it's finally coming to Broadway. Of course, it's be remiss to say it's one of Connor and I's favorite musicals, but was there ever a moment when it almost was going to make it to Broadway over the years ahead of this moment now?
You know, I've never pushed for it to happen in that way, just because Broadway is a commercial marketplace, and I felt like either we have a way to sell a commercial product or we don't. And I thought there will come a moment or there won't. I always assumed at some point it would, but I was not pushing for it because it's, you know, the show does just fine without it. And I didn't feel like it needed to be on Broadway in order to be a good show. It's like, it was what it was. After Cynthia and Joshua had done it, there was a little bit of a push to make that happen. But financially, we couldn't really make that work for Cynthia and Joshua, which was fair. I mean, Broadway is just a very hard model to make work financially. And Cynthia was about to go be a movie star. So, you know, I think there was, yeah. There was a lot of that. And there have been people who have asked, you know, like sniffed around and been like, oh, we want to do a Broadway production of the last 5 years. And I'm always like, all right, well, let me know when you pull it all together. And then they don't, because that's just sort of the way that, I mean, you guys know that's the way the business works.
You mean like producers have said, hey, we want to do this? Or is it stars who are coming to you?
Sometimes it's been producers that, you know, I mean, when I say producers, it hasn't been the Nederlanders saying we're going to do it, because that's not how they work. You know, it's been young people who are like, oh, it's a show with two people. I bet I could get that to happen on Broadway. And then they find out what it is to try and produce on Broadway. And they're like, oh, God, no. So in this case, you know, to have Greg Noble and Seaview and ATG, who are these powerhouse Broadway, you know, they say we're going to do this with big stars. That's what the Broadway business is. Yeah. You know, we do things with big stars. And then they set about saying, how about these big stars? So, you know, I got to meet Nick, who's amazing, who's, I mean, just going to blow everybody away. And Adrian, who I, you know, she blows people away before you walk in the theater. It's, you know, so I was like, if it's going to be the two of them and Whitney directing and, you know, at the Hudson, which is my favorite, you know, of course, we didn't know it as a Broadway theater until a couple of years ago. And now I'm just, I want to see everything there. So I'm like, that's gold. I love that.
I can't wait. I'm wondering, is there going to be a concept, you know, not that you're answering these questions, but just the things I think about, like, how will this look on a Broadway stage? Because I've seen it performed before in many different ways. Actors love, I'm sure you know this. They love to do those songs.
Oh, yes. They have paid for this house that I am speaking to.
I mean, it's funny. Like, I can remember seeing a video of Cynthia Erivo at Marie's Crisis doing I Can Do Better Than That. That, you know, they just love to go out there and sing your music, and people just really connect with them. And that show especially, I mean, it's just, it's such a treat for, I can imagine, a performer. And I was making the connection, like, you know, you had Cynthia did it. She did it before. Jonathan Bailey did it in London. Yeah. And then Ariana has done songs from it. Now they're all going to be in the Wicked movie. And I was like, Jason, you know, if not for you.
No, I have a lot of connections to the Wicked movie. It's a strange thing. When Cynthia and Ariana, you know, it was announced that they were both cast, I texted them both at the same time. And I was like, what strange world is this where I know both of you and I can text both of you? I mean, it's weird enough that I can text Ariana Grande. That's a, you know, let's just acknowledge that that's a strange thing for a human to be able to do. No, it's great. And, you know, the thing about the last 5 years is, when I wrote it, I said, my job with this is to write something that is as good as I possibly know how to write and not to let myself off the hook on anything. Because there are places in Songs for a New World and places in Parade where, you know, you just got to get the job done and, you know, the show's going to open and you got to do what you got to do. And the Hal Prince is yelling at you and saying, get it written. And so you do it. But there were places where I was always like, I wish I had done that better. And my deal with the last 5 years was I want to write a thing that, at least at my age, you know, I was, I guess, 32 when it opened in New York, that I want to be able to say I could not have written anything better than this. Mm. I don't know whether I actually achieved that, but I felt really good about it. I mean, I look at it now and there are things that I'm like, well, right, you're a young writer. But that's, I mean, I that's a good sign to me. That means I'm getting better instead of stagnating. So I like that. But I look at it and I really think, if, you know, if that was the last thing I wrote, then that's a good thing to have, you know, made my legacy, is that piece. So I've always just been very proud of it. It's, you know, it's a very complicated piece for me to watch personally, not just, you know, not just the personal elements of the piece, which are obviously in there, but it's a very difficult show to do. And it can be very hard to watch people try the high jump and not land it. You know, it's like, if you don't stick the landing, it's a tough thing to watch. And there are things that I know about, you know, what they're trying to do that the rest of the audience may not know. So it can be hard for me to sort of watch people, you know, try and climb Mount Everest and then fall off the side. So that's, you know, that's my relationship to it, is it's this very personal and very special piece to me. And I have to be careful that I don't get overexposed to it. So, I've spent a lot of my time sort of saying to people, I'm thrilled that you're doing it. And no, I'm not going to come see it. Sure. Just because it's a lot. Yeah. It's a lot to take.
I can only imagine. My fiance is going to be playing Jamie this spring in Columbus, Ohio here.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And I was thinking about the song, I Could Be in Love with Someone Like You, which of course I had to play for him and introduce him to and whatnot.
And that was replaced then with Shiksa Goddess in the last 5 years, right?
Yeah.
Were there ever any other songs that were, there was a completely different song that was then Elements Might Have Remained, but were swapped out before the album as we know it is now, or the production as we know it is now?
There was litigation with my ex-wife, which is why we changed I Could Be In Love With Someone Like You. But the only other like big material change, there was a section of Climbing Uphill that was different in Chicago. And a lot of it related to Kathy's specific ethnic heritage, which I was asked to cover over, which has actually worked out very well because Adrian doesn't have to pretend, you know, she's Irish Catholic.
Yeah.
But I think that that chunk and I Could Be In Love With Someone Like You were really like the two big material changes. There were a couple of lyrics here and there that I fussed around with. And then, you know, there is a musical change that was not the result of that, but Sherry just didn't sing as high as Lauren Kennedy did. So Lauren, in the next 10 minutes, when it gets to the middle section, I want to be your wife, Lauren's a third higher than Sherry's version of it. And so when Betsy Wolf did it, Betsy did it in Lauren's key, which is, Lauren's key is the one that still sounds right to me because it's the one I wrote originally. And I think everyone else is kind of used to Sherry's key because that's the one that they heard on the album. So Anna in the movie did Sherry's version because that's the one that she knew and was comfortable with. But like Shoshana, when we do it together, she always does Lauren's version of it. So that's a little weird quirk, is this strange thing. Also, Summer in Ohio also, I don't know how Lauren sang it in B. It's an unspeakably high song. So Sherry took it down a half step. And even then, it's hard for everybody. But Betsy, of course, Betsy can sing anything. So she took it up the half step. So I'm not sure where Adrian's going to do it. But that's the mystery there. Mm-hmm. That's the big reveal. What key will Adrian Warren sing Summer in Ohio?
Oh my gosh, I'm like all excited with you talking about these songs, Jason. Oh my God. Okay, you mentioned Lauren Kennedy, and she decided not to take the show to New York because she went and did South Pacific in London, right?
Yeah.
How did you find Sherry then for the New York run?
Sure. I mean, look, we all knew who Sherry was. She was, you know, this astonishingly talented up-and-coming person. I have to tell you that had we decided... Sherry didn't audition initially. Sherry didn't come in. You know, Lauren was a person we chose as a result of a series of auditions, and a lot of people had come in. One of the people who came in was Kelly O'Hara. It was her first audition in New York, and she came in, and we offered her the understudy, and she turned us down. So that was the first time I met Kelly. But so Lauren was the person we chose after that. But I have to say that I don't think Sherry would have come in for that first set of auditions because it involved going to Chicago for the summer. And I think she wouldn't have wanted to go away from whatever work she was doing in New York. So she hadn't even come up in that initial set of auditions. And then when Lauren said she wasn't going to be able to move forward with the show, I believe Sherry came in. I mean, I think we had a whole series. In fact, we did. We definitely had a day of auditions. And I remember that because we were also looking for understudies for the two characters. And one of the people who came in to audition, well, one of the people who was scheduled to come into audition for Norbert's understudy was actually Joe Mahoda.
Get out.
And he was a no-show. And I have the sheet, the audition sheet, and I have written, you know, like no-show next to his picture, which I have. Every year, I just send him a text of that picture just to remind him, you know, that he didn't even show up to audition for my musical in 2002.
Oh, that's hilarious.
God. And then, okay, so fast forward a little bit. You directed the production with Betsy and Adam, right?
Yes.
What was that experience like directing the piece?
I don't know that I had been like yearning to be a director particularly. I always thought I'd probably do pretty well with it. But there was a producer in New York who didn't end up involved in that production, but who said to me, you should direct the last 5 years. We should find an off-Broadway theater and you should direct it. And I don't really know what that was entirely based on, but he started trying to set it up. And so I was teaching in California at the time. I was teaching at USC, and I asked if I could direct a production of a Thornton Wilder play there, just to sort of see if I knew what I was talking about. And it's a play called The Alcestiad that never gets done, but that's part of why I wanted to do it. And so we did it at USC, and I felt like, oh, I think I know what this is. I'm not a guy who's going to create a visual masterpiece. That's not You know, it's not that. I'm not going to have like some iconic, visual coup de théâtre that you've never seen before. But I know what it's supposed to feel like. And I think I can do a good job at getting this show to feel like I want it to feel. And so then the folks at Second Stage said they wanted to do it with me directing it, which I thought was really cool. I mean, it's a beautiful space. And, you know, and it should be said, I wasn't exactly hot shit at the time. I mean, the last show I had done in New York, I think was 13, which had been 5 years earlier and was hardly a hit. So it was a little bit out of nowhere, but I think the piece itself was strong. And part of Second Stage's mission was to give pieces a second showing, you know, so they wanted to do it. And I said I would only let them do it if I could direct it. And that's sort of how that came about. And it was a fascinating experience for me. I felt like I did a good job of it. I mean, like at the end of the day, I know I'm not, you know, the great director of all time, but I felt like I knew how to direct my own piece, which was important. I loved the process of putting it together and working with the designers. You know, I had just Derek McLean, who I think is just the best designer in the world. And
oh, yeah,
that he came on board and was willing to work with me, you know, and we came up with something that was very sort of stark and really exciting and sexy and weird. And we had, you know, beautiful, the lighting and the costume designers were great. And, you know, because I am a musician first, I think I wanted to make sure the musicians were on stage, that they were visible, that they were part of the storytelling. There's always this big push from directors to hide the band. And I'm like personally offended by it. I understand it. It's not that I sort of don't get where they're coming from, but I'm also like, they're making the music. It's a really exciting thing to watch it happen. Like there's real drama to be had in allowing the audience, if they want, to take in what those musicians are doing. But I also, you know, it can be hard on a small space that they don't just take over because all of a sudden all you're doing is watching a bunch of guys tune their guitars, you know. So I get it, but I wanted very much. So one of the things I asked my musicians was to actually memorize the score so that we didn't have music stands, but so that they sort of were just in there making the music with the actors all the time, which they did, and they still are mad at me about. But I loved Betsy and Adam. I loved getting to work with them. Weirdly, it was at the exact same time that everyone was putting the movie together. So I was sort of shuttling back and forth between directing the play and then doing the pre-records for the movie itself and working with Rich LeGravenez on making the movie. So all of that was sort of tied together and you know, not uncomplicated, but very lovely. And Stacey Mindich, who had her first Broadway producing credit was on 13.
Oh.
And then she said, I love the last 5 years. I want to be part of this. I want to help. And so she was invaluable in making that production work and getting it recorded and getting it to the finish line. And then obviously she, you know, produced Bridges of Madison County as well. She was this wonderful champion that I got to work with. It was a beautiful time. And, you know, I don't want this to sound sort of self-pitying. I haven't had a lot of moments where I get to walk into the theater and feel like I have a hit. You know, most of my shows are a struggle on a commercial level. And so I tend to like get really excited during previews and then the reviews come out and then you just sort of watch the grosses sort of trickle down for the rest of the run. And that can be sort of demoralizing. And the last 5 years was the opposite of that. The last 5 years, it felt like every time I walked into the theater, I was at the biggest hit in town. And I just never had that feeling, which is sort of, I mean, it's certainly not the reason I go into this, but it's a thing that you think is going to happen when you go into, I'm going to write musicals for a living. You expect that thing that you see in movies where you just walk in and, you know, there's confetti flying around and people are, you know, showering you with praise. And honestly, it's only the revivals that have ever been that last 5 years. And obviously the parade that we did last year with Ben and Michaela felt like that also. And other than that, it always just feels like I'm sort of, you know, naked in the cold and, you know, no one will give me a blanket. And, you know, I love having created the work, but the process of putting the work on Broadway or off Broadway, even these days, it feels very exposing in not a great way.
Yeah. I will say I felt a strong energy at the Songs for a New World, New York City Center concert. When you heard those first couple notes. Everyone went nuts.
I mean, well, that was also, it was like 1,700 people. It was just sold out. Yeah, I mean, what you have to know about Songs for a New World is when we did the show, it was in a theater that I don't think had 100 seats. I think it was 96 seats at the WPA. And it was, I mean, and it was not full ever. You know, nobody knew, my great story, Daisy Prince was directing it. And so, you know, her dad was Hal Prince and he was the king of Broadway at the time. And Andrew Lloyd Webber actually came to see Songs for a New World. I presume Hal had said, oh, you should go see my daughter, you know, something like that. And he came and he left after act one. And that was the kind of effect that Songs for a New World had, was it was just sort of like, people would say, oh yeah, it sounds like there's some cute thing going on, but they just didn't get it. And so then like 25 years later, it's selling out City Center. And it was amazing. Mm-hmm. But I have to just accept my entire career as sort of happening in the future somewhere.
Well, that's an interesting way of putting
it. You're ahead of your time, Jason. That's what it is.
I mean, that's what I say to myself.
I can't believe Andrew Lloyd Webber missed I'd Give It All for You. I mean.
Let's say he missed a lot.
He missed a lot. He did. He absolutely did. Dylan, do you want to talk about 13 a little?
I have one question about 13. My favorite song in the show, Being a Geek. Why didn't it end up on Broadway?
Oh, it's a terrible story about Being a Geek. Okay, Being a Geek should have ended up on Broadway. Biggest problem that we had, first of all, I love 13, and it's very close to me. I don't know, I mean, I'm very glad it was on Broadway for a variety of reasons, including the fact that I think part of why it makes any money now is because it was a Broadway musical and that people want to produce shows that were on Broadway more than shows that were at the Paper Mill Playhouse once. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm very happy it was, but I don't think it belonged there. I don't think it was a Broadway musical. And along the way of making it feel like a Broadway musical, our producer determined that it had to be a two-act show. And the problem with Being a Geek is it falls right in the middle of the piece and it's a downer. And so that was where the intermission was always going to land, was right on Being a Geek. So we didn't do it. I had written another song called Here I Come, and that was the end of act one. And then there was the act break, and then opportunity started act two. And so we were going to do it that way. And we started previews, and everything about the previews of 13 on Broadway was a catastrophe. I don't even think the kids were aware of just how chaotic and nightmarish the whole production was. And it was my first time doing a commercial Broadway musical other than doing Urban Cowboy, which was a whole other kind of chaos. But, you know, so it was this big, expensive Broadway show with a bunch of kids that was about a bar mitzvah. I mean, everything was sort of off. And there was a moment where it was like 2 days before the critics were supposed to show up. And previews are a very hard time to get anything done in New York. There's an old mythology that like, oh, you can fix a show in previews, and you can't. You can do very little in previews. You can tighten it up, you know, but like the idea that we're gonna make wholesale changes and put in new songs and rewrite character, that's from the 60s and 70s. You can't do that anymore. It's too expensive and the technology is too hard. But we had decided that part of the problem with the show was that the intermission was now a big issue, that people would go out, you know, halfway through the show and they'd be like, I don't know what's supposed to happen in act two. There weren't enough stakes. There was, you know, it wasn't a thing. And so we said, well, let's cut the intermission. And they said, well, if we cut the intermission, then what are we going to do about Here I Come, which feels like a big moment and wasn't landing. It was not that number wasn't working. I said, well, let's put back Being a Geek. And so we did it for one night. And I will say that the director hadn't shown up for tech, which is a longer story than I know how to tell. So I ended up running the tech, and this was before I had directed the last 5 years. But luckily, Chris Catelli sat with me. I think the key to say is that we hadn't cut the intermission yet. So Being a Geek ended act one. And so there was one night where if you came to see 13, you saw a version of Being a Geek that we had staged and lit that afternoon. And it ends in a very sad, you know, it ends with, you know, that, and then the light sort of came down and I was sitting watching it and I just sort of like literally like slid until I was out of my chair and hoping to like get under the seats so that nobody would see me. It was a catastrophe. And what we decided after that was just cut the intermission, cut being a geek, cut the whole transition. We'll just go right from one thing right into opportunity and we'll do that. And that's what we did. And that's how the show opened. And it was fine. And then ultimately we rewrote the show and being a geek is now in the show. You can't do it without being a geek, no matter what you do. So that was it. But it was, you know, I've had a lot of strange nights on Broadway, but the single worst moment of my life was the lights coming up after being a geek that one night. That was the night where I was like, it's time for me to move. I'm done with the business. I gotta get out. And we did, I will say, we tried really, really hard to get it in the movie. And it was in several drafts of the movie, but the director was like, what is a geek? It feels like this terminology from 1957. It's not, kids today don't know from geek. That's not a word. And maybe you want to call it being a something else. I'm not going to pretend I'm up to date on the, I don't have the riz. So she was trying to figure out another thing it could be. And ultimately it was like, cut the song. It doesn't matter. Cut it. You're cutting every other song. It doesn't matter. Cut that one. So, but it's in the show. It's even in the junior version. When you do 13 junior, being a geek is in there. I love it. I used to do it in my concerts and it was too hard to sing. Like I would sing it and it would totally blow me out for the rest of the show. And I was like, I have to stop doing being a geek. And if you ask Jamie, my drummer, it used to show up on the set list for like a year and a half. It would show up on the set list and we'd get right up to it. And I would just make the gesture to the band that we're going to jump past it. And Jamie was like, oh, are we going to put in being a geek tonight again? Knowing that we were never going to do it. And so I never do it. Maybe I'll do it at Carnegie Hall just for you.
Oh,
if
my
you
goodness.
Go to Carnegie Hall, I'll do being a geek.
All right. okay. Well, before we started recording, I showed you that I have a Bridges poster on my wall. You have one on your wall amongst your other incredible shows, you know. I have to tell you, I think you wrote some of the most beautiful music to ever exist in Bridges of Madison County. I was telling Dylan earlier, I was listening to it this morning at the gym, which was an interesting, you know, workout playlist, but you wrote songs in Bridges that make me want to feel that passionately in love. Like truly, thank you. Unbelievable music. And the vocals, Kelly, Steven, oh my God, it's beyond. My favorite song in Bridges, and which it has been from the start, is Another Life.
Thing about Bridges is when, you know, I had written the last 5 years and the whole production was very complicated and difficult for me. And I really did leave town. I mean, I moved to Los Angeles and I was there for a long time. And while I was in LA, I was writing Honeymoon in Vegas and I was writing 13. And those were the shows that were going on in my head. And Marcia Norman and I got a commission to write a piece for the Kennedy Center. And it was an orchestra piece called The Trumpet of the Swan, which you can still get on Spotify, which I love desperately. It's really, really fun. And so we wrote an orchestra piece with narrators. But when we got done doing it, we had such a great time working together that we said we should do like a real show. We should do a real musical together. And so we told our agents, oh, if anything comes up, let us know. And like very shortly thereafter, the agent wrote to Marcia because Marcia had done The Color Purple and was sort of this person who was famous for now being able to turn novels into musicals. So it came to Marcia. And before Marcia told me that she had gotten the call, I had written her an email and I said, you know, the thing I really want to do is something that is very big and romantic and singy, because I'm either writing a show with a bunch of 13-year-old kids belting all night long, or I'm writing this very sort of crazy comedy where everybody's nuts and singing in Hawaiian. And I said, I just want to do something that feels very big and romantic and beautiful. I want big singing. I want singers to open their mouths and people to go, that is the most beautiful sound I ever heard. And she wrote me back. She said, well, I think I have the project for you. And the thing about The Bridges of Madison County is the novel, of course, it's unreadable. Maybe you guys love it. I can't bear it. It's terrible. It's a terrible book. And you know, when it came out, we all made fun of it. That was a thing. You know, my mother's an English teacher, so I take great pride in making fun of bad writing. So we all were like, oh God, The Bridges of Madison County. But she said, I got this offer about The Bridges of Madison County, and I think it may be our big show. And I said, here's my only request. Do I have to read it? And she said, no. And so I didn't. I did. It only takes about 2 hours to read it anyway, but I didn't read it. We did everything based on Marcia having read it and come up with her version of what the story was. And I said, that's what I want to write is Marcia Norman's play. I'm not particularly interested in the Bridges of Madison County. So I think there is some combination of what that book, you know, it's obviously this very resonant story for a lot of people. Yeah, I mean, I think it's still one of the best-selling novels of all time. So clearly it means a lot to a lot of people. But there's also something about Marcia's sensibility about how to take that story and tell Francesca's side of it, you know, this thing that she had to say. And I think those two things combined allowed me to just sore. And I had Kelly, you know, and we knew we were writing it for Kelly from the outset. And to have an instrument like that, I was like, oh, well, I have to take advantage of it. I mean, I have to let her really like sing. And then we got Steve Pasquale, and I was like, this is what I wanted. I wanted this kind of singing. So it was very gratifying, you know, on that front, and still is, you know, especially a lot of the classical people, you know, when I do symphony gigs and stuff like that, they're all Bridges people. You know, the musical theater people are all last 5 years people, but the music people all go to Bridges or they go to Parade, but Parade is a slightly more complicated show.
Sure. Wow. So from Kelly being offered the understudy slot at last 5 years to then leading Bridges of Madison County.
Well, and turning us down. And let me keep pointing that out. We offered her a job and she said no.
I need to ask about Another Life. Like I said, it's truly one of my favorite songs. Who came up with the idea that, okay, let's take Robert's ex?
I didn't know. It was totally me. You know, the part of the problem with the story is that Robert is not a person who can open up. He doesn't, you know, that's his whole, he's this the lone cowboy, you know, thing. And I was like, well, I have to tell his backstory somehow, and he's not going to be able to tell it. And you know, this podcast is going to go on for 9 hours. But so there was, Marcia had won in an auction. This is a very Marcia story, but Marcia had won in an auction a week at an extremely expensive hideaway on St. Bart's. Like this unbelievable, like it was a private villa on the grounds of a very big hotel on St. Bart's. And she said, I have this, let's you and I go and we'll write Bridges there. And I said to my wife, I said, Georgia, do you want to come meet me in St. Bart's like over Christmas? And she was like, the fuck are you talking about? And I said, I'm going to go to St. Bart's where we have two private pools in our villa with a private chef. This is not the life I live, incidentally. I tell this story and everyone's like, oh, Broadway. But this is not any part of my life. But Marcia had figured out this boondoggle. So I was in... This gets more unbelievable, but I swear it's true. There was a recording studio in the basement of this villa.
Oh my God.
But there wasn't a piano. There was a keyboard that was not great. But there was a guitar. It was an acoustic guitar with rusty strings. And I don't play guitar, but I had already decided that I was going to write Bridges on guitar. I was going to figure out how to play it and write it on guitar because I thought all the piano stuff I know felt sort of too jazz. Like that's just sort of where my hands go, is to a sort of very specific harmonic vocabulary. And I thought I can do something different if my hands, you know, are not going to places I recognize all the time. Mm. So most of Bridges was written on guitar. And so there was a guitar there at the recording studio underneath the private villa. And so I took the guitar and I would literally sit out on the beach at our private, like, it was so fucking crazy. So I had the guitar and I would just sit there. So when I hear Another Life, what I hear is like the island breeze I was blowing, man, because I was just sitting there on a tropical island playing my guitar under a palm tree. And that's where I came up with, you know, this thing. You know, I can't play guitar, but I can still play that. And that's where that thing came up. And what I remember about writing the song, I mean, Marion, that character, is only in one paragraph in the book. That's all in the novel. So Marcia did not know that was coming at all. But I said to her, I think I have an idea and just let me roll with it. But when I finished the song, I brought her down to the recording studio so I could play it for her. And I said, but here's the thing. I think whatever show we're writing has to be a show that has room for a song like this. Because it's a very unconventional thing to ask of an audience in a musical, to hang with a character for, I mean, it's an almost 5 minute long song, and you have to hang with a character who you don't know and you're never going to see again. And it is really important that we pay attention to everything she says. And Marcia said, well, we just have to make sure we've written that kind of show then. And so that was sort of our guiding principle from there on out, that we needed to have a show that was sufficiently theatrical that we could do something like that. And so Another Life is not just one of my favorite songs that I've ever written, but it was really key to understanding what the theatrical language of The Bridges of Madison County was going to be.
You also just made my life by playing a bit of it on the piano just now. So thank you. A lot's happened on this podcast in almost 5 years, but that kind of took my breath away. Yeah. So thank you. Thank you for that. Okay. Well, Jason, thank you for joining us. Before we say goodbye, we do end on a dose of drama. This is a little thing on your mind. Could be a pop culture recommendation, something you did last night, something you're doing tonight, something you want to rant about, rave about, promote, etc. Drama could be truly anything. I've got some drama on my mind. I've been flying a lot for the last couple. Honestly, summer is always so crazy busy. I feel like I'm always flying somewhere for this wedding or that event, you know, whatever, whatever. And this is not an original thought, but oh my God, why do we still board planes front to back and not back to front? It is so crazy to me having to walk all the way to the end, you know, after first class is already boarded, after everybody else is on there, with my honestly slightly oversized carry-on and personal item hitting people, and the flight attendants are trying to serve drinks. Oh my God, it is like so stressful for everyone involved. I seriously think society would, almost all of our problems would be cured if we really just decided to board the plane back to front. So thank you for that little drama.
I agree. I'm with you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for hearing me.
You know how I feel.
You don't know how you feel about it?
No, I think we should just have only one person on every plane.
That would solve even more problems.
That's what, well, I'm on a small plane to St. Bart's, I think that is how it goes. Isn't it? You would know, right, Jason?
Well, I think I took a commercial. the private plane has not been part of my life, but
I'm too scared to go on one. Is that okay to say?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, the one time I was on one was, oh my God, I'm going to sound like this person. Ben and Michaela were invited to sing at the White House for like a Jewish thing. And so Ben's mom actually works in the White House, worked on with Biden on policy of Jewish affairs. And, so they hired a private plane because it was on a Tuesday. And so we had a show that night. So we flew out of the private airport, and we did the, so I have done it. And you won't, when you do it, Connor, because you will, because your time will come, when you won't be scared of it. It's not I have flown, not in private planes, but in like those little tiny things that you just like puddle jumpers, and those they're scary, but they're also like, they make you understand why people love flying. Like you feel like you're flying, as opposed to like I'm sitting on a bus with a lot of people and hoping that they give me food. Like when you're in one of those little planes, it's an amazing feeling. You're like, oh, I'm in the air. Like, this is not a joke. Like I'm glad we were able to talk so much about airplanes.
I know. Okay. My dose of drama real quick is actually a question for you, Jason. You've written songs. A lot of celebrities have sung your songs. Is there anyone out there, a big singer, anybody that you would love to sing one of your songs, record it, anything like that? Like an Adele or a
Gaga.
Lady Gaga. Yeah.
I'm not going to say no to anybody, but there are people who are really foundational to who I am as a musician. And so like getting to do a thing with Stephen Sondheim was this thing that just felt like closing a circle in this unbelievably beautiful way. And so I want, on the one hand, to be able to do more of that, like to be able to work with Billy Joel or Paul Simon or Joni Mitchell, you know, or Steve Reich, or, you know, just there's Stevie Wonder, these foundational people to how I write. There's some of that where I'm like, oh, come on, what, you know, that who's going to be mad about, you know, Stevie Wonder singing one of my songs? That would be a really great day. But I also, I'm really looking forward to, as I sort of was able to do with Shayna, to look at the people who are coming up who think of my work as foundational to them, and to be able to sort of make music with them and to share music on that front. So I don't know that I have specifics because I'm not much of a star worshiper. It doesn't mean a whole lot to me, but I love making music. It's really cool and really fun and always mysterious and, you know, just has so many possibilities. I just want to make more music with people who love doing it.
I love that answer. That's perfect. While you were talking, it made me think about your working relationship with Shoshana Bean. And I just love when the two of you perform together. I feel like the way she interprets your music is just beyond.
I don't really ever want to do a concert without Shoshana, but it's, you know, now that she's a big Broadway star, it's not always possible. But basically, if I would just go around and do concerts with Shoshana all the time, that's all I would need to do. That would be fine.
Can you write a Broadway musical with her in mind? You know, a la Kelly and Bridges.
Well, I mean, theoretically, yes. It's just very hard to get Broadway shows produced. And so I try not to get caught in that trap. Like the fact that she was in Mr. Saturday Night was this unbelievable thing. But if I had said from the outset, I will only do this if Shoshana Bean plays this part, it wouldn't have happened. I don't have that kind of power. There are a couple of people in the business who have that. Like if Lin-Manuel says, I want to write a show for Shoshana Bean, then he's going to write a show and she'll get it up. I don't have that kind of power. And so I know that it would get sort of stuck in some weird thing. But when the right project shows up for both of us, then we're both going to do it and it's going to be amazing.
Hell yeah.
And meanwhile, we get to sing together all the time, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's what we're both in it for.
Yeah. Do you know what, you don't have to say, obviously, but do you know what you're going to sing together at Carnegie Hall?
Yes.
Ooh.
Ooh, okay.
Love it.
Okay, Jason, do you have a dose of drama to take us home today?
I have to tell you, I may not be useful to you here. The thing about... First of all, because I'm much older than you guys are, I know I'm making it sound like I'm 90 and I'm not, but I've been around a lot longer and I have kids and, you know, I sort of like high drama with low stakes is of no interest to me. It's like a real drag. I have people in my life who are very ill and I have people in my life who, you know, are in deep financial crisis. And I think the country itself is in a very scary place. And by the time this airs, the debate between Harris and the evil person will have aired and we'll know more than we know now. But I'm so tense about politics, and I don't want to spend my time being tense about politics, but I have been for, you know, years now. So I don't have drama because in a lot of respects, what I mostly have is gratitude. I have this unbelievable gratitude that I get to do this thing, that I get to live this life, that I'm healthy, that I'm in love, that I have wonderful children, that I have people that I care about, and that the people that I care about get to do what matters to them as well. I think that's part of what Shoshana and I share is this real sense that it's just this miracle that we get to do this, that we get to make music, but also just get to be here. We get to try and make the world better. We get to try and solve problems, and we get to try and, you know, just make someone feel better than they felt yesterday or know that they're loved even if they can't feel better about it. So I'm not great on drama because the world is going to provide enough of it anyway. I'm actually here to just sort of, you know, I have my stories to tell, and what I hope is that they make you feel something.
And you know what? Whether we're listening to one of your songs that's recorded or it's a live performance or seeing a production of one of your shows, I certainly feel like you make the world a better place. So thank you for that. You come to sing a song about hope. You know? We appreciate your time today. Thank you so much. Your Instagram handle just changed.
It did.
You're now
Jason Robert Brownstagram. Yep.
That's so
okay.
Cute.
So everyone should follow you there. Yeah, we love that. Everyone should follow you there. They should follow us at the Drama Podcast, Connor at Connor McDowell, me at Dylan McDowell. Listen to us on iHeartRadio. And thank you again for your time today, Jason. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. And mazel tov on your upcoming wedding. I'll talk to you all later.
Thank you.
Thank you. Connor, I'll see you next time.
Drama.